the headlines, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank since Wednesday rises to 3. Human rights groups renew calls for the closure of the U.S.-run Guantanamo prison on the 21st anniversary of the opening of the notorious facility. And Peru witnesses new clashes between police and demonstrators, angry over the ouster and arrest of former president Pedro Castillo. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli brutalities against Palestinians show no sign of abating. The regime's forces have killed one more Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The victim has been identified as 41-year-old Samir Aouni Harbi Aslan. The incident happened early on Thursday when Israeli troops raided the Ghalandia refugee camp north of the city of Al-Quds. Family and friends gathered at a hospital morgue to mourn his death. In reaction to the killing, the resistance movement Hamas said Palestinians will continue to resist the Tel Aviv regime until their land is liberated. The killing comes just a day after an Israeli settler fatally shot a 19-year-old Palestinian near the city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Also on Wednesday, Israeli troops reportedly shot another young Palestinian man in the head during a raid on the Balata refugee camp. He later succumbed to his injuries. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli raid of the Ghalandia refugee camp in the occupied West Bank is yet another act of violence against Palestinians.
This time, Israeli forces have raided Ghalandia refugee camp between Al-Quds and Ramallah to conduct arrests among Palestinians as usual. During this operation, Israeli forces raided the narrow streets of Ghalandia refugee camp and arrested from Ghalandia 12 Palestinians, including the son of this Palestinian martyr, 17-year-old Ramzi Aslan. The Israelis wanted to arrest him, and here his father tried to prevent the Israeli soldiers from brutally taking his son and from beating him. However, Israeli forces opened fire at the father, Samir Aslan, and they stripped him from his clothes and left him on the ground. He was bleeding. A number of soldiers were around him. And it was, according to the footage that we have received, the Israeli soldiers were surrounding Aslan and left him bleeding until he succumbed to his injuries. Today, 18 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces, as I have mentioned. A dozen of them were arrested in the Ghalandia refugee camp, and the remaining were arrested in the Dahesh refugee camp in Beit Lahem. In addition to one Palestinian was detained by the Israeli forces during a raid to Qalqilia, northern the occupied West Bank.
Doctors and medical experts in Yemen believe that Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces are using biological weapons, which are believed to be the reason for the increased cancer and birth defect cases in Yemen. Yusuf Mauri has a special story.
Sana is dying. She was born just a few days ago, but because of a rare birth malformation, doctors believe she only has a few days to live. Sana is one of the thousands of Yemeni babies facing a similar fate. Here in the Sab'een Hospital in the Yemeni capital, doctors say they have been receiving birth defect cases at an alarming rate since 2015. That's when the Saudi-led coalition launched its war on Yemen. Doctors here are convinced that biological weapons were employed by the Saudis.
We've received many birth defect cases throughout the years. However, this is the first time we received a case like this. She does not have the bottom limbs or kidneys or even a urinary tract or liver. She's missing all of her bottom half organs. Malformation cases have risen significantly since 2015. We believe the rise in these cases is due to the hazardous poisons from the weapons being used in the war.
Cancer cases are also on the rise. The spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health says that the data and statistics recorded since the war started indicate that biological weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition are the main cause of the steady increase in cancer and birth defects.
These cases are rising in the areas that were targeted by illegal weapons in a number of provinces in Yemen, which has led to a significant increase of various kinds of cancer cases and also birth defects and miscarriages. It was never like this prior to the war.
We visited the registration office at Yemen's only oncology center. It was packed with people pushing their way to register for cancer treatment.
I am here to register for medication. I have oral cancer.
I have just received another case. The person who just registered is from Ebb and has liver cancer.
According to Yemen's Ministry of Health, the number of cancer patients increased by more than 50% since the war was launched in 2015. The Yemeni Ministry of Health says it will form a committee to officially investigate the main cause for the increase in birth defects and cancer cases in the areas that have been hit the most by the Saudi airstrikes. Even if it's evident that prohibited weapons were utilized by Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces, it is unlikely they will face prosecution, since most of the weapons used in the war are supplied by the American and British governments.
Doctors and medical experts say the increase in cancer and birth defect cases is rooted in the 8-year Saudi-led war that has polluted Yemen's air, water, and food. They blame the Saudi-led coalition's use of prohibited weapons such as biological weapons, toxic gases, and cluster bombs. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Asian stock markets push higher as China emerges from strict COVID restrictions and optimism for a pickup in demand grows. MSCI's broadest index of Asia-Pacific shares outside Japan rose 0.5% and touched an almost seven-month high. This comes as the fall in China's consumer inflation and a larger-than-expected drop in factory gate prices in December. Inflation in 2022 rose by an average of 2%, making China an outlier compared with other major economies where prices soared on the back of a spike in energy and food costs and supply chain volatility. There's hope that falling inflation will reduce the need for interest rate hikes. A major British union says 100,000 of its members will go on strike on February the 1st in a dispute with the government over pay, pensions, and job security. The announcement came at a time that the UK is experiencing a wave of strikes across all sectors ranging from healthcare to railways. The Public and Commercial Services Union said it had warned the government their dispute would escalate if they did not listen. The Union Secretary General added that the dispute could be resolved if more money was offered to its members. Different government departments and public sector bodies were hit with strikes over the last month as pay rises failed to keep pace with double-digit inflation. Thousands of ambulance workers held a second day of strikes on Wednesday while many schools in Scotland were closed by a teacher walkout. Rights advocacy groups have renewed their calls for the closure of the U.S.-run infamous Guantanamo Bay prison, which has a colossal legacy of abuse. On the 21st anniversary of the opening of the notorious facility, some 160 international rights groups have sent a joint letter to U.S. President Joe Biden urging him to shut it down. The facility is a symbol of Washington's so-called war on terror and is globally known for widespread violations of human rights there. Some detainees released from there and even U.S. personnel had recounted harrowing stories of torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and forced feeding. One rights group has described the prison as a symbol of injustice and disregard for the rule of law. The prison has never been closed despite promises by respective American presidents. For more on that, we're joined by Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson, who's joining us from Sydney. Mr. Anderson, why is Gitmo still open?
Seems to be a relic of this so-called war on terror, which is, no one had ever heard of such a war before, an endless war, effectively. And it was a specific decision of Washington more than 20 years ago to create a facility for jailing people without charge, being held under military detention, specifically outside the US jurisdiction, and let's remember this is a part of Cuba excised wrongly by the US when it intervened in the War of Independence over 100 years ago to maintain a military base in another country, so that the laws of the US would not apply. So there's only, I think, 35 prisoners still there, but successive presidents have talked about closing but have done nothing about it. It seems to suit them to keep this type of punishment without charge or trial while talking about human rights and rules-based systems and so on. So it's a relic. Perhaps it seems to be something that is popular amongst the Washington regime, the Washington elite, because they are still using it, even though there's very few people held there.
Sure. America's director at Amnesty International has said in a statement that Guantanamo remains an indelible stain on the United States history. More than two decades after its opening, President Biden must finally close this chapter and ensure it is never repeated. Now, the prison has never been closed, despite promises by numerous American presidents. That specific director also added that none of the inmates have had a fair trial. They've never been charged. Why has it not been closed despite all the international condemnation, despite the promises by American presidents? Congress, I believe, has a lot to do with that.
That's right. Congress has had a strong say in it. The presidents, Obama and Biden, have talked about closing it, but claim that there's some obstacle there, and part of that obstacle is in Congress. But I think, in reality, it suits the deep state in the U.S. to have this facility outside the law, outside any sort of law, to be able to use it as a type of a jailing of people, which they've used other countries. We know there's this question of sending people around for torture in other countries where the type of rights that might apply within the US jurisdiction don't apply there. So clearly it suits them to keep it open, and they're using it, they're keeping it up their sleeve for future reference, basically. It certainly costs a lot of money to have 35 people there. It's not about that. It's about having this an extra tool that is not subject to scrutiny, not subject to the law. That's the way they like it.
Tim Anderson joining us from Sydney. Thank you for your comment, sir. Elsewhere, another political embarrassment for the White House as aides to the president have reportedly discovered more classified documents from a location Joe Biden previously used. The initial batch of files was discovered in November at a Biden's private office, but only came to light this week. The records, including intelligence memos and briefings, date back to Biden's vice presidency. The president claims he didn't know about those files and was taken by surprise. The White House has yet to comment on the newly discovered materials. The Republican majority House of Representatives has requested information from Twitter and the Treasury Department. The House has already voted to create a new committee to launch an investigation into the issue. Former President Donald Trump is also facing a criminal probe for allegedly keeping classified files despite calls by the National Archives to turn them over. There's no end in sight to violence in Peru over the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. New clashes have erupted between police and Castillo's supporters who were trying to take over the airport in the southeastern city of Cusco. In some videos circulating online, demonstrators could be seen receiving assistance for their injuries. A prosecutor says the protesters were off to repeat what unfolded in the city of Juliaca, where 17 people were killed after demonstrators tried to take the city's airport. On Monday, Peru has been roiled by protests since last month after Castillo was removed from office and taken into custody. People are calling for his release as well as the resignation of new president Dina Boluarte. More than 40 Peruvians have been killed during the unrest so far. Well, the United States says attacks in space would invoke its defense treaty with Japan, as the two countries are alarmed over China's rapid advances in space technology.
We're working to deepen our cooperation across every realm, land, sea, air, and yes, space, cyber, and outer. The outer space component of this is important to the security and prosperity of our alliance. We agreed, as you've heard, that attacks to, from, or within space present a clear challenge. And we affirmed that Depending on the nature of those attacks, this could lead to the invocation of Article 5.
Washington has also announced the deployment of a more agile marine unit on Japan's southern island of Okinawa. That's part of recent high-level talks between officials of the two countries and a joint statement to modernize their defense alliance. U.S. officials said on Wednesday that the country would also increase its anti-ship missile capabilities in Japan. Tokyo last month unveiled plans for its biggest military buildup since World War II. Tensions have been on the rise between China and the U.S. over a host of issues. Beijing is opposed to the U.S. military presence in the region as well as its nexus with Taiwan, which China claims as part of its territory. China has repeatedly warned that the Western troop presence puts the regional security at risk. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has called for increased cooperation with Washington on the operation of U.S. nuclear assets to defend South Korea. The U.S. has deployed strategic weapons capable of delivering nuclear bombs to South Korea in response to North Korean missile tests. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol told journalists this week he wants to be more involved with the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons to defend his country from North Korea.
We have not seen any results yet, but South Korea and the U.S. will cooperate in the system, which the U.S. has been operating unilaterally. Although nuclear assets are U.S. assets, South Korea will participate in their operation, and the two countries will work together to respond to the threat of North Korea's nuclear escalation.
President Yoon has resumed large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea war games and strengthened Seoul's alliance with Washington. However, U.S. President Joe Biden has so far stopped short of coordinating the deployment of nuclear weapons. The U.S. has conducted several missions to South Korea involving so-called strategic assets, weapons that can deliver nuclear bombs. Amid the South Korea-U.S. military buildup, civil society leaders meeting in Seoul this week called on President Yoon to make greater efforts to pursue dialogue with North Korea. Under the previous progressive president, Moon Jae-in, engagement with North Korea reduced tensions, which have only flared up again with the election of President Yoon and renewed North Korean missile tests in 2022. South Korean peace activists say 2023, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War armistice, marks an occasion to increase their campaign to officially end the war. Meanwhile, President Yoon plans to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the South Korea-U.S. alliance with record-level military exercises. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Terrorist attack in Shah Charaq Shrine disgraced the hypocritical black-hearted Americans. This is the part of Imam Khomeini's speech in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on Tuesday, December 20, 2022, which was delivered when he met with a number of the families of the martyrs who were murdered in the Shah Charaq terrorist attack. The tragic yet glorious tragedy that took place in the holy shrine of Ahmad ibn Musa Shah Charaq, peace be upon him, is one that will remain permanently in history. The enemy's culpability in this case is different from many other acts of terrorism that have taken place inside the country. Sometimes they attack a military unit. On another occasion, they might target a political group. This is one matter. But then they attack a number of pilgrims. It is not a political gathering, nor is it a battlefield. It is a place for making a pilgrimage. It is a place for seeking nearness to Allah, to God. People went there from different places, from Tehran, from Hamadan, from Gilan province, from Shiraz itself, from Kokiluye and Boyer Ahmad province, to plead with God, to have a quiet moment with God, and to confide in the friends of God. Then they were attacked like that.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemy was totally disgraced in this case. Who is this enemy? Is the one who committed this crime the only enemy? He obviously is an enemy. He is a criminal. He is a treacherous criminal. But he was not the only one. There were people who were backing him. They say it was the Daesh, ISIS. Well, yes, but who created ISIS or Daesh? Who created this dangerous creature? The US has clearly stated that they created ISIS. They explicitly stated this. Not now, 7 or 8 years ago, they said they created Daesh. They are guilty, the ones who are holding up the flag of human rights. May God curse these black-hearted wretched liars. They act in that way, but they speak in a different manner about human rights, the rights of women, and about various issues concerning humanities. They say one thing, but act in a different manner. They were disgraced. They are totally hypocrites. And a person who is a hypocrite is an unbeliever. And an unbeliever is God's enemy. They are God's enemies. Those people are unbelievers, hypocrites, and the enemies of God. They were disgraced in the tragedy that took place in Shah Charaq Shrine.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. airstrikes in Somalia increased 30% in 2022 as the Biden administration increased U.S. involvement in the Horn of Africa country that is experiencing a new wave of fighting between the government and Al-Shabaab terrorists. In 2022, the Pentagon carried out 15 airstrikes on Al-Shabaab. According to data from the U.S. Africa Command, these strikes resulted in the death of at least 107 terrorists. The U.S. has conducted military operations against Al-Shabaab in Somalia since 2007. AFRICOM estimates the group has 5,000 to 10,000 fighters across the country of 15 million, controlling large swathes of land in southern and central Somalia. On Saturday, Somalia's government claimed for the first time that Al-Shabaab called for open negotiations with the government as it conducts a military offensive against the group it described as a total war. The uptick in fighting between Al-Shabaab and government forces has come as the country experiences a fresh wave of attacks. This shows that the U.S. so-called counterterrorism military operations in Somalia have yielded few results. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country. Al-Shabaab recently claimed responsibility for a twin suicide car bombing in Somalia's Hiran region that killed around 20 people. Last year was a particularly bloody one. More than 100 people died in October when two car bombs exploded at a busy Mogadishu intersection. In August, Al-Shabaab launched a days-long siege on a Mogadishu hotel that left more than 20 people dead. In 2020, former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration moved to withdraw all 700 American troops from Somalia after a three-decade presence in the country. Soon after the Biden administration came into office, it reversed the Trump move. And in May 2022, U.S. officials said the president approved a plan to redeploy troops to Somalia. Some U.S. lawmakers have raised concerns about the U.S. military campaign in Somalia, which has been carried out on the grounds of the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, passed following the 9/11 terror attacks. Successive U.S. administrations have used the AUMF as a pretext to approve military action in countries like Afghanistan, Yemen, and Djibouti, despite no formal declaration of war by Congress. In December, Democratic Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs and Senator Elizabeth Warren sent a letter to the Pentagon arguing that the Defense Department was undercounting civilian casualties in Somalia. The U.S. Congress is the branch of the American government that has the authority to declare war. Despite Congress not having declared war in Somalia, the Biden administration has used the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force to bypass restrictions. The 2001 AUMF has been used by successive administrations to justify military operations against a number of groups. In at least 19 countries, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. Today, the authorization for the use of military force is the legal basis used to justify all current wars. For this reason, it is called the blank check for the endless wars. And while the Biden administration has signaled it supports ending the different 2002 AUMF specifically for Iraq, it has not shown any support for revoking the wider-ranging 2001 AUMF, despite calls from the lawmakers. In August, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin lauded the country's military operations in Africa, saying it works alongside our friends as full partners to strengthen bonds, to tackle common threats, and to advance a shared vision of an Africa whose people are safe and prosperous. But a recent report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies contradicts this. The report says terrorist group violence in Africa has risen inexorably over the past decade, expanding by 300% during this time. The U.S. has spent roughly $2.5 billion on security assistance for Somalia since 2009. It has also conducted at least 265 airstrikes since 2007. However, despite years of military presence in Africa, U.S. has failed to combat extremists and terrorists. The British royal family may appear to be prim and proper to the public. However, they have faced their fair share of controversies over the years. From the separation of Charles and Diana in 1992, and the famous comment of the late Princess of Wales that there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded, to the Megxit when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stepped down from their royal duties. Now, few years into the new year, the royals are on the back foot. The Duke of Sussex's tell-all memoir, with its bombshell revelations, has turned into a big challenge for the monarchy. Prior to the official publishing of the book, multiple media outlets reported they had secured copies of Harry's autobiography. Among the jaw-dropping claims is Harry's reported retelling of his scuffle with his brother, Prince William, in 2019, his use of cocaine as a teenager, and killing 25 people in Afghanistan when he was a helicopter pilot in the country. He also said he confronted discrimination and neglect from the royal household from a younger age. While Buckingham Palace has kept silent, Harry's revelations have drawn mixed reactions. Some have denounced Prince Harry's tell-all memoir for putting family arguments out there for the world to see. They say Harry's account will be damaging to the monarchy and undermines the king at a time when he is trying to show the institution is modernizing. Others say they sympathize with the sibling rivalry the prince describes and other elements of his experience. The fact is, the British monarchy is by its very nature hierarchical, and this has led to Harry feeling like his spare part. A former royal biographer has said he is perplexed by Harry's memoirs, saying it contains the kind of revelations you would expect from a B-list celebrity. Meanwhile, the royal analyst and biographer of King Charles, Catherine Mayer, has said Prince Harry's book could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy, given the lack of trust in the state at the moment. She said anger over racism, misogyny, and wealth in the royal family can undermine public consent for a monarchy. Survey results over the years show that younger people are less likely than older people to say that it is important that Britain has a monarchy. Indeed, just 14% of under 35-year-olds take that view compared with 44% of those aged 55 and over. This suggests support for monarchy will decline as today's older generation is replaced by younger Britons. Revelations in Prince Harry's newly published book include the murder of 25 people in Afghanistan while serving with the British Army in the country. The 38-year-old described killing targets as moving chess pieces, noting that he was not ashamed of doing so. High-profile British veterans have criticized Prince Harry and warned the high-profile admission could increase the risk to his personal security. Retired Army veteran Colonel Tim Collins said the prince's kill count talk was crass, and we don't do notches on the rifle butt. Others said Harry had appeared wrongly to dehumanize those he killed by describing them as chess pieces removed from the board. That's while the Taliban have accused the prince of committing war crimes on his military tour in Afghanistan. Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, described the Western occupation of Afghanistan as a horrible moment in human history, saying comments by Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hands of occupation forces who murdered innocent people without any accountability. Last year, an investigation revealed commandos in the UK's elite Special Air Service Corps killed at least 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand Province from November 2010 to May 2011, but the military chain of command concealed concerns. The investigation found that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids during the long war in Afghanistan, and weapons were planted on them to justify crimes. In 2001, the US and its close allies, including the UK, invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda. The invasion proceeded by over two decades of war in Afghanistan and cost 241,000 lives.
The United States has yet again imposed a fresh round of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This time, targeting the country's suppliers of drones, Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of Kursk Aviation Industries. The U.S. Department of Treasury said the group, which has been under U.S. sanctions since 2013, was a key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. Washington said the drones have been used to target civilian infrastructure in Ukraine during the conflict with Russia. Among those designated was Sayed Hojatullah Qureshi, Quds Aviation Industries board chairman and senior official in Iran's Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics. The Treasury said Qureshi had led Iran's military research and development efforts and was responsible for negotiating Iran's agreement with Russia for the supply of the Iranian drones for the war in Ukraine. The Treasury also imposed sanctions on Qasem Damovandian, Quds Aviation Industries managing director and board member. It said he had likely facilitated the group's supply of drones to Iran's military services and the training of Russian personnel on the use of drones. The accusations come as Iranian officials say Ukrainians have so far failed to provide any evidence for their claim that Russia was using Iranian drones in its war on Ukraine. Speaking following a technical meeting between Ukrainian and Iranian experts, Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani said the Ukrainian side had stopped short of presenting any evidence of Russia's use of Iranian drones in its war in Ukraine. Prior to that, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian had also reacted to the U.S. and other Western countries' allegations, noting that Tehran had provided Moscow with a limited number of drones, but the delivery had taken place months before the war in Ukraine. The sanctions come as the U.S. Treasury says it will continue to use every tool at its disposal to deny Russian President Vladimir Putin the weapons he is using to wage his unprovoked war in Ukraine. The Friday sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization, which the Treasury claimed was the key organization responsible for overseeing Iran's ballistic missile programs. The move freezes any U.S. assets of those designated and generally bars Americans from dealing with them. Those engaged in certain transactions with the targeted individuals also risk being hit by sanctions. The United States has previously imposed sanctions on companies and people it accused of producing or transferring Iranian drones that Russia has used to attack infrastructure in Ukraine. The military-related sanctions on Iran are just a small part of the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Washington has left no stone unturned in pressuring Tehran to fulfill its demands, given that the so-called maximum pressure policy has so far failed to produce the intended result. It is widely believed that by pressuring the government and subsequently the people of Iran, what the United States is and has been pursuing after 40 years of the Islamic Revolution is seeking regime change. The sanctions against Iran over the supply of drones to Ukraine comes as the West has itself been fanning the flames of the Ukraine war by providing billions of dollars worth of military assistance to Kiev. That includes the United States, Germany, France, and the UK. The weapons they provide range from mortar fighting vehicles and Leopard tanks like AMX-10RC armored combat vehicles and Abram tanks. This is while providing Kiev with such weaponry could increase the risk of direct confrontation between Moscow and the West. Iran has been under the UN and US sanctions since the 1979 revolution. What comes to the spotlight is the futility of such all-out anti-Tehran measures. Despite 40 years of pressure and sanctions on the Islamic Republic, not only Iran has not stopped, but it has progressed, so the sanctions tactic has lost its effectiveness in a sense. This rather indicates that the United States seems to be escaping the frustration caused by its failure against the Iranian nation's iron will. The resilience of Iran's economy is not the only reason why the unlawful American maximum pressure campaign of sanctions against Tehran has failed. The maximum pressure policy against Iran was initiated by former U.S. President Donald Trump when he unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal to strike a better agreement, which he hoped would restrict Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Eventually, his hopes and aspirations became more and more far-fetched with each passing day. Now, the Trump-imposed sanctions regime has been maintained by the Biden administration, although they realize it has been an abject failure. Could this be because they see no alternative course of action? What seems to be of very high significance is the fact that the Biden administration has realized that Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign not only didn't work, but only helped strengthen the Islamic Republic of Iran in the international arena. Yet Iran stands. How so? Iran's economy and partners are diversified with initiatives to circumvent such U.S. measures.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense minister's meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Well, everyone wants to know when Imam is going to come. But for that, we have some signs. Some of the signs are definite signs and some are indefinite. And among the signs, one of the things that is described is the advent of Sufyani. Who is he? Is that a sign of a definite one or an uncertain sign?
We'll talk about that with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome, sir.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Karim, in our previous episodes, we are discussing about is Sofiani a symbol or a reality? And to explain the fact, you gave us a couple of narrations. You said there are some narrations wherein they said that there's name of Sofiani has come, or other narrations talk about his lineage. Some talk about his physical features. So to expand the topic more, I would want you to please start.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So in the previous session, we rejected the theory that believed that Sofiani is a symbol, or it may refer to a movement. So based on that, we accept the theory according to which Sofiani is the name is referring to a certain person.
Okay.
And I think you refer to all those points. And I may add the narrations which talk about the time and place of his uprising and the country that he will attack and so on and so forth. So to claim that all these are not referring to a person and all these are symbolic is at least against the narrations, and we cannot accept this theory. So the conclusion of that discussion is that for sure Sofiani is referring, in the narration, is referring to a certain person.
The first thing that's clear over here is that Sofiani is not a symbol, it's a reality. Now, is it just one person or a number of people?
That's a very significant topic about the personality of Sofiani. So far we proved that Sofiani is referring to a certain person.
Okay.
But now the question is that, is it only one person named Sofiani, or we
is
might
it
have
many people?
Yeah, many people, various Sofianis in the course of the history. The famous idea that we believe in that is that at least the Sofiani in the time before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and after his reappearance is referring to one person, not more than that. So the question is that why he is called Sofiani? It might be because of the fact that according to some people, he is one of the offspring of Abu Sufyan, the father of Muawiyah. So that is why he is called Sofiani. I mean, his lineage, of course, we'll talk about his lineage. His lineage goes back to Abu Sufyan. Okay. And the second point is that he is called Sofiani because of the fact that he has the same features as Abu Sufyan. The other viewpoint is that no, we have some narrations according to which we may claim that we have had different Sufyanis in the history. Sofiani can refer to different people. All the people who had a kind of uprising and movement against the truth, and they have the same feature as Abu Sufyan, they can be called Sofiani, even if they are not from the same lineage. So in the history, we have had different Sofianis, and one of them is the Sofiani that will come after the reappearance or before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yeah.
What is the answer here? We believe that at least the conclusion based on the narration is that the Sofiani of Akhiruz-Zaman, the end of time, before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi and close to the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is only one person. So at that time, the time that we have before us, and inshallah it would be in early future, we will have only one Sofiani.
Yeah.
We will not have more than that.
Okay.
Because of all those narrations which talk about his name, his lineage, his physical features, the time and place of his movement and all those events, in all these narrations we have the term As-Sofiani. And in Arabic language, As-Sofiani with Hamza and Lam means it is referring to one person.
Okay.
And not more than that. So we do not see in the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt about Sofiani that, for example, the first Sofiani will do that, the second Sofiani, and the last Sofiani will do such and such. In the narrations in which the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt have asked them about Sofiani, his features, his movement, none of them has asked the Imams with the title of first or second Sofiani or the last Sofiani.
Yeah.
So it seems that the understanding of the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt was also that we have only one Sofiani at the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Having said that, there are only three narrations according to which we will have more than three Sofianis.
Okay.
And those people who believe in the second viewpoint, they have referred to these three narrations, and we need to address them. In the first narration, Ibn Hammad quotes from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, according to which the Holy Prophet has said, Sufyani's uprising will be after 39 years. So this Sufyani is referring to the time of the Prophet and after him in the early Islam. So for sure we'll have another Sufyani in Akhir al-Zaman. So the conclusion is that we'll have more than one Sufyani. This is one narration. The second narration is in the book At-Tashrif bil-Minan, in which Imam Ali alayhi salam talking about the difficulties, the fitnas, the seditions in the future. He says that the first of these problems is Sufyani, and the last of them is Sufyani. فَقِيلَ لَهُ وَمَا السُّفْيَانِ وَالسُّفْيَانِ Oh Imam, you are talking about two Sufyanis. Who are they? And the Imam says that one of them, according to this narration, is Hijri and the other is Shami. This is the second narration. And the third narration is from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, in which he says, and this narration, the chain of the narration is authentic. He says, the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is certain. For sure. There is no doubt about that. This is definite. The same is true about Sufyani. This is one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. There is no Qa'im except that there is a Sufyani opposing him.
Yeah.
This is in Qurb al-Isnad, page 374, hadith number 1329. So, what is the meaning of this narration? Before that, let me tell the dear listeners that the first two narrations that I shared, they are weak narrations. So
we don't have a very strong chain of narrations. That's what I wanted to ask you. What about the chain of narrations?
So
now?
The chain of these two narrations, the first and the two, are weak and they are not mentioned by authentic Shia sources. So we reject them. But the third narration that is quoted by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is with an authentic chain. And according to this narration, each Qa'im has a Sufyani. Now the question is that, what does it mean? Do we have more than one Qa'im? The answer is given by Imam Jawad alayhi salam. In that narration, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says, مَا مِنَّا إِلَّا وَهُوَ قَائِمٌ بِأَمْرِ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ You know, the term Qa'im has a literal meaning. One of the literal meanings of the word Qa'im is that the one who establishes the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says that all of us, that is all the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, we are Qa'im. But this Qa'im is different from that Qa'im, which is one of the titles for the 12th Imam. In this case, Qa'im is referring to the literal meaning of the word. Qa'imun bi'amrillah. All of us are Qa'im, meaning that we are establishing the religion of God. That Al-Qa'im, who will purify the earth, he is the one whose birth would be hidden from the people. This is in Kamaluddin, page 378, chapter 36, hadith number 2. So the point is that these two narrations are against what we mentioned before. According to one understanding, all the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam
have faced a kind of Sufyani.
Exactly. They are establishing, trying to establish the religion of God. That is why they can be called Qa'im.
Okay.
And all of them are opposed by
They're
different
confronted
people.
By Sufyani.
And those people can be called a Sufyani, meaning that an oppressive ruler. But when it comes to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he is called Al-Qa'im. I mean, the title of Al-Qa'im is referring to Imam Mahdi, the 12th Imam. And the Sufyani, which is one of the signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is the Sufyani that will come before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So the conclusion is that although we may claim that each Imam has different enemies, and according to one understanding, we may call those enemies as Sufyani, meaning that